good evening and welcome to the NFL Draft. Tonight, we officially welcome the next generation of players. So if you're ready, are you ready? Let's get it started. The NFL Draft is officially open.
Welcome inside the Locked On NFL Draft Podcast. I am Trevor Sikkema. With me is Benjamin Solak, both of us, of course, from thedraftnetwork.com. It is a beautiful Monday edition of the podcast, which, of course, you guys know what that means. We got a lot of NFL to get to. We got a lot of games to recap, a lot of performances to try to quantify. But before we do that, we gotta remind the people about what Pepsi's been telling us for a long time, and that is that this football season is going to be different. But Pepsi's here to get us ready for game day, no matter how we're watching this season. Pepsi is the refreshment that you need to power through game day and become a member of the League of Football Watchers, because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game, it is made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. We had a lot of exciting scores this week, Ben, and a couple blowouts, but dude, even the Bills-Jets game felt like it was, right? it was something to watch and keep an eye on for most of the contest. But Browns-Bengals, one-score game. Panthers-Saints, one-score game. Lions-Falcons, one-score game. Steelers-Titans. I mean, like, everything just seemed like it was coming down to the wire, and that's without even mentioning the craziness that was the Seattle Seahawks and the Arizona Cardinals to cap it all off on Sunday night.
My father's a Steelers fan, and my mother is a Jets fan, and I've said no Eagles this week, so I'm kind of tuned in on the other games. Steelers are up 27-7. Jets are up 10-0. I'm texting both. Both are feeling great. We're vibing. Barbs are being thrown. Outlandish projections for the rest of the season are levied.
Of course.
And then slowly the text just devolves,
yes,
into greater and greater fear and despair. And then obviously, of course, the Steelers save it. And my father, as he always does, shrugs off the missed field goal and goes, well, of course it was missed. The Steelers were supposed to win. You're like, no, like that was a gift. You're lucky. He's like, it's not luck. It's winning the game. It's winning the close games. He missed the field goal, Dad. We just argued about that for like 10 minutes.
Well, your dad's a pastor. He knows that the Steelers have had some divine powers around them for the last, seems like 15 years.
If Ben didn't throw the two red zone interceptions, then it wouldn't have even mattered anyway. Yeah, but he did. That's the point.
Let's recap the league before we dive into our segments for this week. Detroit Lions, Atlanta Falcons. It was a battle of the Mats. Matt Stafford, Matt Ryan. And if you listen to this podcast at all, you know how much weight that held for the two of us. Ben has been team Matt Ryan. I have been team Matt Stafford. And Matt Stafford somehow comes back to beat the Falcons in... Oh, I'm not even going to... We're gonna get to exactly how this game ended the way that it is, because it's going to be on one of our segments. But Lions win 23-22, win by a single point. Falcons now 1-6. Lions 3-3. Cleveland Browns made it a fun one. 37-34, they take down the Cincinnati Bengals. That was a back-and-forth battle between Joe Burrow and Baker Mayfield. The Packers, they beat the Houston Texans 35-20. Somebody on the Texans did not tell the Texans team that Devontae Adams is back and healthy. That's the only way that I can explain this game, because Devontae Adams was literally the only thing the Packers offense had going for them, and that is all that mattered. Houston could not even come close to stopping him. Carolina Panthers, man, they made it close, but they fell to New Orleans Saints 27-24. New Orleans 4-2 on the season. The Panthers are 3-4. Bills and Jets, Ben mentioned it a little bit there. Jets got out to a double-digit lead on the Buffalo Bills, and I'm not going to lie, it got to the point where we were pretty deep into that second half, and I was sweating a little bit. I was like, are the Jets really going to do this? Is this offensive coordinator switch for Adam Gase really going to be a catalyst for the first win? But didn't end up happening. Bills 18, Jets 10. Jets still winless on the year. Steelers-Titans, battle of the undefeated teams. Steelers take them down 27-24 in another close one. Cowboys and the Washington football team, man. We're gonna have to have a conversation about the Dallas Cowboys, and I know we're gonna get to it in a little bit in this show, but they fall 25-3 to the Washington football team. Not great. Both of those teams now 2-5 on the season. Buccaneers handle business against the Raiders 45-20. I said last week I figured the Buccaneers would win, but I thought it was gonna be close with the Raiders. It was not even close. Buccaneers now 5-2. They're rolling. They're looking good. Kansas City Chiefs get back to it. They take care of business against the Broncos. I think they had a kick return touchdown, a pick six, and then, of course, the offensive touchdowns as well. They win 43-16. Jaguars-Chargers made this an entertaining one because the Chargers were up 16-0 to start the game, and then the Jaguars came back, and then they were up 21-16 just to eventually lose 39-29. Chargers are 2-4 on the season. Jaguars 1-6. Not great. 49ers. We're going to have a talk about what the 49ers exactly are because after a couple weeks ago, they lost to the Philadelphia Eagles in a game that nobody really expected them to look as bad as they did. They come out, they dominate the New England Patriots at home. I learned that this was just the 10th loss at home in the regular season for the New England Patriots in the last 10 years, which is wild. 49ers, 33. New England Patriots, 6. And then the final thrilling game of the Sunday slate, Seahawks and the Cardinals. Cardinals took this one in overtime, 37-34, but it was entertaining all the way down to the end. Ben, what is your top story from this week's games?
A lot to pick and choose from. I'm landing on Joe Brady, which we've talked a little bit about the Panthers. We've talked about how, you know, the defense is flying around. Jeremy Chinn had a couple great plays. Once again, Brian Burns had a strip sack. Once again, they've got young talent. It's exciting. And we've gestured to the offense, but not in a way that is sufficient to talk about. You know, Teddy Bridgewater goes 23-28. 250 yards, 2 touchdowns, no picks against the New Orleans Saints. Bridgewater's last 3 games have been out of this world. He had 27 for 36 for 300 against the Falcons. He was 16 for 29, 219 against the Bears. That game he had 2 picks, but he was a good passer. He just wasn't getting the scores that he usually gets. And then this past game against the Saints as well. Even going back to the Arizona game in week 4, which was their second win, 26 for 37, 270 yards, another 2 touchdowns. If you look at since week 4, so the last 4 games for Bridgewater and the Panthers offense, they are right now 5th in team EPA per dropback per runningbacksdontmatter.com. On that, yeah, it's Ben Baldwin's site.
I know. It just makes me laugh every time because it's great. It's a great site, and I use it all the time, but then I just sometimes forget that that's what the URL is.
Yeah, their team is 5th in total EPA per dropback. The running game is below average, but they're 5th in EPA per dropback. And then Bridgewater specifically for quarterback efficiency is 6th in EPA per play, which means he's with Ryan Tannehill, Tom Brady, Justin Herbert, Matt Stafford, Aaron Rodgers, Derek Carr, Sean Watson, Drew Brees. That's his company. And like, yeah, is it surprising that Carr's there? Yeah, it's surprising that Herbert's there? Yeah, but it's surprising that Teddy Bridgewater is there. They're playing very, very well on offense. And when you open things up and you take a look at why, Bridgewater is throwing the ball well. I mean, Bridgewater's throwing some balls on the move. He's pushing the balls to some intermediate windows that are impressive that I wasn't necessarily sure you were going to get from Teddy. But they've got, you know, like Curtis Samuel rushing touchdowns, you know what I mean? They've got DJ Moore, like, you know, multiple motions uncovering against the linebacker, right? Everything that you want to be getting at the NFL level, Brady's getting 7 weeks in, right? Like, he's immediately clicking. Like, it is not an exaggeration at all to say the offense translated.
Yeah.
That at which he was successful at LSU, using empty protections in third and short situations to get easy reads, getting matchups in the slot with his top, you know, with his top weapons, using the running back in the receiving game on option routes. All of the stuff that at LSU was working, you were like, what will he have to change in the league? He's generally applying the same stuff. Like I said, I think he's incorporating more pre-snap motion. He's doing less with empty protections, just kind of acclimating to the NFL. It's clear that he's translated. And accordingly, with his success at LSU in 2019 and then the success of the Panthers offense in 2020, he's going to get an interview at least for a head coaching gig. I don't know if he gets it.
Yeah.
He's young. It'd be a risk. But he's going to get the interview because, you know, McVay broke the seal, right? It's, you know, young offensive minds, get him as soon as you can. And Brady's definitely in that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, he's been fantastic. And some of the points that you and I went over on this podcast during the summer when we kind of expected Carolina to give teams more than they could handle, like at least from what people were predicting, it was because I feel like Joe Brady was so good at getting guys in space. And I felt like Teddy Bridgewater, for as much as people want to say like, oh, Teddy's not like this franchise changing, can overcome a bad roster and overcome some bad situations. Like, I will agree with you. Teddy's not quite that quarterback, but I do think Teddy's a really smart quarterback, and I think he's a good facilitator. Is the arm legendary? No, it's not. And so you see some limitations there, and I think that you've seen that throughout his NFL career when he's been in and out of the lineup. But what he does well is I think that he facilitates the ball. And what Brady does really well is he designs guys to get in open space. Right now, 7 games in, the Panthers have 2 of the top 4 yards after catch players in the NFL right now in Robbie Anderson and then running back Mike Davis. They also have DJ Moore in the top 20. He's right around 18 or 19. So, like, they have a lot of guys who Bridgewater has been able to get the ball into their hands. And because the design is so great with space for them to work with, they're able to get a lot more than you would just think from the normal air yards of saying, like, oh, okay, Bridgewater's arm can get it from here to there, and that's about it. Well, it's becoming a lot more than that. And the marriage and the chemistry, the relationship, whatever you want to call it, between Bridgewater and Joe Brady is completely showing up to be effective every single week. And they are taking teams down to the wire. They would not go away last week against the New Orleans Saints. And I really do think that Brady has a big reason or has a big claim to how well Carolina has been doing this season. I think that Rhule is getting a lot of the credit right now, obviously, because he is the head coach. But I'm with you, man. I think that Joe Brady might be getting some head coach looks this season. I don't know if I don't think that he's going to be a head coach next season. I really don't. I think he's still super young, and I think they'd probably want to see him for at least another year before they really have some confidence enough for somebody to completely offer him a head coaching job. But he is well on his way to being known as one of the best offensive coordinators in the NFL from what we've seen early on.
Right. I think the only way you get it next year is if you have that which McVay had when the Rams hired him, Wade Phillips. Right? You need...
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
You need to have...
I mean, Wade Phillips is currently a free agent.
Free agent. Right.
Defensive coordinator.
But yeah, so you need to have the steady hand of a defensive coordinator, veteran, established in the league with head coaching experience, that you say, okay, we're going to bring in this young, you know, offensive guru who's only been on an NFL coaching staff for a couple years, only seen it done for a couple years, admittedly seen it done by Sean Payton and Matt Rhule, two pretty good guys to see it done by. And he's going to be able to have his hand held on some of the non-Sunday aspects of head coaching by this veteran defensive coordinator. That's how I think I'd be comfortable with it. But the thing is, you don't want to be second on Joe Brady, because if you're second on Joe Brady, you don't have Joe Brady. Right. You got to be first on him. So somebody's going to take that plunge.
Listen, all I'm saying is Atlanta Falcons steal Joe Brady from the Panthers in the division, make him the head coach, hire Wade Phillips to be the defensive coordinator. Wow, look at that. Look at me just fixing the Falcons in one sentence. Thanks to the lack of natural athleticism or commitment, or maybe just overbearing sports parents, fewer than the 1% of the 1% of the 1% will ever play professional football. But instead of entering the NFL, they have now joined another league, the League of Football Watchers. This season's going to be different. Pepsi is here to get us ready for game day. No matter how we watch, Pepsi is a refreshment that you need to power through any game day experience, because Pepsi isn't made for those who play the game. It is made for those who watch it. Pepsi, made for football watching. Ben, this is a weird topic for me as the top story, because I almost, like, really don't believe it. It truly feels like this weird kind of dream, but I mean, I got to say it. Are the Bucks the best team in the NFC? Like, are the Bucks the number one seed right now? Because look at the other teams in the NFC who would compete against them, right? I'm 100% trying to be skeptical of this. New Orleans Saints clearly are not the juggernaut that we thought they were going to be going into the season. Now, they have the win over the Bucs in Week 1. I understand that, but that was Week 1 of this brand new Buccaneers team, and I think the Bucs have had a lot more control over what they want to have in games than the Saints have. I think Brady's a lot further along than Breeze is, who looks a lot more washed in his older age. Green Bay Packers, another team that I would say is great in the NFC. Bucs just put an absolute beating on them. And I'm going to say, yeah, I'm going to go like game for game in some instances. So I don't want to say like, oh, the ones where the Bucs won are the real games, and the ones that they lost don't really matter. But they put it on the Packers and locked them down at what they did best. Seattle Seahawks, we watched them last night. They got nothing on pass rush, man. They've got nothing. And if you're going to sit there and let Let's say they face off against the Buccaneers in the NFC Championship game. It's Russell Wilson, so he's got all kinds of magic. So it'd come down to the end, and that would be an awesome NFC Championship game. But that Bucs offensive line is already playing well. The Seahawks cannot get to the passer at all. Brady sitting back there with Chris Godwin, Mike Evans, Rob Gronkowski, and now he's going to throw Antonio Brown, and they've got Scotty Miller, Cam Braid, all those guys to round it out. It's just, there is a legitimate argument to say that the Bucs could beat the Seattle Seahawks there. So with all of that to say, the Bucs are absolutely in the conversation. Now, in terms of stats, they've got a top 10 defense in third down defense. They're number one versus the run. They're number nine versus the pass. They're eighth in scoring. They're fourth in sack percentage. Seventh in interception percentage. 10th on total third down defense. 10th in red zone defense. And then on the offensive side of the ball, they're fourth in the red zone. Tied for first in like goal to go situations. Second in least amount of sacks allowed for the percentage. 8th in interception percentage. 15th in total offense. 8th in passing. 19th in run. 13th on third downs. Like, this is truly a complete team with stars at the key spots. And so, as weird as it is for me to say this, at 5-2, the Bucs could legit be the best team in the NFC.
Seattle. I can't. Yeah, okay, Seattle lost to Arizona. Divisional game in Arizona. Pass rush was bad. I'm not going to dispute that at all. That's been the problem for them. My words this week is the Seahawks secondary, because I like Shaquille Griffin's film out of 2019. I thought that he'd taken a step forward. I know the interception numbers weren't there for him in 2019, but I thought he was worthy of an extension. He's played pretty poorly through 7 weeks, and his interception numbers have gone up, but he's given up a ton of targets. Quentin Dunbar, who, you know, was like PFF's top five graded corner last year or something, I wasn't, you know, as gung-ho about. People were like, oh, Quentin Dunbar, the new CB1. I was like, all right, well, we kind of know what Quentin Dunbar is. Let's assume he's not, you know, like having a career resurgence at 30 or whatever it is. But I liked him as a corner too. Obviously, bringing Jamal Adams was great. I love the impact that Quandre Diggs had on this secondary last year. Marquise Blair and Ugo Amadi, Utah and Oregon, 2019 draft, are two guys, both of whom I liked as backup safeties. Ugo to play in the slot. I thought they were good. Blair and Adams' injuries hurt. Diggs is still playing well, but the corners are really struggling. And that's the thing, is like this passing defense, I agree with you. Rush and coverage combined can't take away a good team, right? So if you're Seattle and you're going to have to beat a good team, which you're going to have to do in the playoffs a couple weeks in a row, you got to be regularly hanging 30-plus. The Bucs offense has looked like we've wanted it, like we expected, like we hoped in the last 2 weeks. But the Seattle offense been looking like it for the last 7 weeks. So for me, it's just, yeah, for me, it's just like I might get here. And, you know, let's not forget, coming into the season, I had a higher record expectation for the Bucs than you did. I really thought they'd be able to get this thing coalesced quickly. And it seems like they're figuring that out.
Right. Yeah.
But I need to see it over a duration. Obviously, beating Green Bay was really high quality. The way they stuck it to the Raiders was nice. Got a couple turnovers, kind of amped up that score a little bit there late. Let's not forget, this thing was 24-20 in the fourth quarter before the floodgates really opened. So I just need to see it for a little bit longer to be able to say it. I definitely think one seed, though, if we're talking about like the actual seeding, is really within reach for the Bucs, because Seattle's got to deal with two more games against 49ers, one more game against the Rams, one more game against the Cardinals. No, they haven't even played the Rams, have they? I can't remember. They have to deal with at least four more divisional games.
Yeah.
And that division is a nightmare. First division ever through 7 weeks of the season have everybody over 500. So they're going to drop a couple that the Bucs don't have to worry about as much, because they're going to have the Falcons, the Saints, the Panthers.
Right.
And so that's a big deal for Tampa in that fight for the one seed. So I think the one seed certainly is within reach. Best team in the NFC right now, I'm hesitant.
In terms of 538's playoff percentages, the Bucs currently have an 18% chance to have a first-round bye, where the Seahawks have a 20% chance and the Packers have a 23% chance. So they're behind them. They're also tied with the Chicago Bears, funny enough, for that. But they have an 88% chance to make the playoffs, and I think they actually have the second highest odds to win the Super Bowl, though, in all the simulations that they run, which I think is kind of funny there. But this kind of goes back to what we were saying last week with the Pittsburgh Steelers. when I say like best in the NFC, I suppose you just have to put the top guys in a group unless there's such a far and away team that you can obviously put at number one. Because right now I would say the Bucks, the Packers, and the Seahawks. I would give all three of those teams any chance to make the Super Bowl in the NFC. Like at any given Sunday, any one of them could beat the other. And I think that when you are in that conversation of within the best, then you have to be at least willing to say that they might be number one. So that's kind of where I am with Tampa. What did you say? So you're eating my words. We'll bounce around here. You mentioned the Seahawks secondary. My eating my words. Oh, wait. Was there something else you wanted to say on there? Like a little bit more information?
No, I was in on the Seattle secondary. I obviously thought the pass rush was going to be bad. I didn't think it was going to be the best unit, but I really liked what they've done at safety the past couple of years. Dunbar, sure. I think, was a smart addition. I thought they were going to be good, and they were going to look worse because of a bad pass rush. And they're still looking worse because of a bad pass rush, but good is a extension to which I'm unwilling to go when it comes to the Seahawks secondary right now. They need better play from Griffin. And Dunbar can get better too, but right. Griffin especially, like they got to step things up here.
I felt bad for Dunbar on the DeAndre Hopkins touchdown because, one, the Cardinals did that thing where just like everybody was looking to the sideline and then they purposely snapped the ball so the defense wasn't set and the defense like didn't even know if the play was going on. And not only is guarding DeAndre Hopkins hard enough, Quentin Dunbar then had to do that like with that trickery involved, and I felt I felt bad for him. My eating my words is the Dallas Cowboys. It's the Cowboys everything for me. Because going back to the preseason, I had the Cowboys finishing 10-6. I had them winning the NFC East, which I guess they can still do. But holy cow, is this team bad. And
reeling, dude.
I understand that Dak Prescott is not there. And anytime you are down your franchise quarterback, almost everything needs to kind of go out the window or at least be suspended when it comes to any kind of preseason or pre-expectations before that injury. However, there is nothing about this team that tells me they have any fight. And the evidence for that could not have been greater than when Andy Dalton laid motionless on the field after a dirty late hit by Washington linebacker John Bostic. And not a single Cowboys player did anything to get up in the face of any of the Washington dudes, in Bostic's face, in anybody's face, as they watched their signal caller just lay there on the turf. Like, after the game, Mike McCarthy, the head coach, said, "We talk a lot about respect and about playing for one another, and that didn't show up when nobody had a fire within them watching Dalton lay there on the ground." And I think that's a manifestation of the Cowboys. That's everything right there for it. McCarthy can think one thing about that locker room. It's clearly not the other. You know, Jane Slater tweeted a week ago after the Cowboys lost 38-10 to the Arizona Cardinals that some of the players just think that none of these coaches just know what they're doing. They're in over their head. They're not the right men for the job. And I think you saw that attitude come out on the field when they didn't even have the pride to stick up for their own guy. As he got hit from a dirty, vicious hit. Cowboys right now are bad. This is an offense that has Ezekiel Elliott, Amari Cooper, Michael Gallup, CeeDee Lamb. A good offensive line. I understand it's beat up a little bit, but a good offensive line. They got Tony Pollard as a backup to Ezekiel Elliott. I know that Dak Prescott isn't in there anymore, but still, Andy Dalton's been around the league for a long time. He's got to be able to facilitate stuff with that offense. Come on, they scored 3 points. They scored 3 points against the Washington football team. Look, Mike McCarthy's probably not going anywhere, right? He signed a 5-year deal. I think he's making more than $6 million a year. He's not going anywhere after this season. But it's just been such an uncomfortable and uneasy watch of what's been going on in Dallas, given the results. Because, like, right off the bat, you remember when they were going through this head coach process? The Cowboys had the chance to make a big splash, right? I mean, Jason Garrett had been the head coach for a long time. And they had this chance to really bring in the next up-and-coming guy, the guy to take this team over the top, to make a huge splash. Right. And Jerry Jones had that chance. And there were so many guys that they could have brought in. They brought in two. Marvin Lewis and Mike McCarthy. And after what was reported a 12-hour interview process with Mike McCarthy, they end up hiring Mike McCarthy as head coach. One of the boasted lines from them about this interview was that he said that he watched every single play of the 2019 season. He then says in his introductory press conference that he lied about it. He's sitting next to the two people that hired him, and he said he lied about it just because he wanted the job. Well, guess what?
Which, honestly, I gained respect for him.
Oh, no, listen. He even says right there, finesse God. He says, I wanted the job. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, you have to respect this kind of finessing. However, if you were the Cowboys, you were in trouble. You hired a guy off of what you are now learning was him just telling you what you wanted to hear, and that's showing up out on the field. This Cowboys team is bad, and there is not a lot of hope right now for things to get better. I don't think McCarthy's going to go anywhere, at least anytime soon. But man, it don't look good in Dallas.
Mm-hmm. So there are several things when it comes to Dallas. The first thing that I think should be said blanket is that they're extremely banged up, not only at quarterback Dak Prescott, but also on the offensive line. And that's, I think the offense would look a lot better under McCarthy if just even the offensive line issues weren't true. Like, I picked Washington to win this game, and the reason was because the matchup difference between the Washington defensive line and the Cowboys offensive line was just too much to ignore, regardless of who was under center, in my opinion. So that's one. That makes things bleaker for the Cowboys outside of McCarthy's control, outside of anybody's control. Two, Dalton gets nailed by Bostic, just lit up. And there was a commentary by McCarthy. I think he got asked a question, and there was a question floating around Twitter, which was, why did nobody get in the face of John Bostic right on the team? If you watch the clip, I mean, five offensive linemen go sprinting right to Dalton. Somebody starts gesturing for the cart. You know what I mean? Like, I think that after the Dak injury, they just saw another quarterback go down. Because usually when it's like, all right, quarterback got an ugly hit, who's getting in the face? It's like the tackle. You know what I mean? It's like you're getting your franchise left tackle. Tyron Smith's going to murder somebody. That's mm-hmm. Tyron Smith's job. Firstly, they've got one starter in. So it's a bunch of backups, right, who maybe like don't have the same relationship quarterback to offensive line as you typically see. But also, I mean, they just had Dak riding on the ground in pain. And then Dalton all of a sudden has no helmet and is clearly just like cold cocked. And so they run to him. And I don't know, like that, I get like the whole like symbolic nature of it. Like, Dan Orlovsky has a big, like talking about how this is bad, how nobody got in Bostic's face. Obviously, like I think if somebody got in Bostic's face, I would understand it. I remember when there was an interception return and I think it was John Allen took a shot at Nick Foles because like, it was an interception return, so he could. And Jason Peters literally would have ripped John Allen limb from limb if the refs didn't stop him. You know what I mean? You see that, you're like, that's
right, though. That's
right. I think it's justified. I think it's understandable. Is it critical? Especially in a context for the Cowboys, where this is their second quarterback on the ground in 3 weeks. Like I don't know. I like to think that if I were on the field and the hit happened to Dalton the way it did, I would have run to Dalton and been like, dude, like I would have wanted to see the lights in his eyes. And then, yeah, I would have wanted the cart because, like, you're probably scared for another one of your quarterbacks. So, I don't know. Like, it's just, like, it's a big narrative thing, which to me can get blown out of proportion. So, I don't know. Like, if you watch the video, like, it's not like the offensive linemen go, oh, dang, and then they, like, walk away. They, like, go running up to Dalton. So that, like, whole narrative thing is interesting to me. But as a umbrella commentary, what do the Cowboys have to point to? Many people have brought up how much money Ezekiel Elliott's making. He cannot positively impact the game. A lot of that has to do with the offensive line injuries, like I brought up. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the Cowboys paid a running back who does not have passing game ability. And all of a sudden, when they really can't get a running game going with their offensive line, Elliott does not have much to contribute in the passing game. Elliott also, like, I think Elliott's a really good natural runner, but he's clearly, kind of big play hunting when he needs to just kind of accept the fact that he's going to grind out 4-yard carries. That's the best thing he can do for this offense. Right, and then meanwhile, defensively, they went bargain binning in the secondary, and they're paying for it. They needed a safety, brought in only HaHa Clinton-Dix. He wasn't good enough to displace Damian Wilson. Wilson's playing badly. They let Byron Jones walk in free agency, didn't want to give him the big contract, wanted to give it to Jalen Smith. Smith's really, really struggled so far this year, and Trevon Diggs, second-round pick, not able to replace Byron Jones. Who would have thunk it?
Right.
So they made a lot of personnel choices on defense. They got good on the defense line, Alden Smith, Christian Griffin, you know, Gerald McCoy. They made all those additions. That hasn't really had the positive impact. And then they shirked the second levels and it's come back to bite them. So that to me is personnel mismanagement. That ends up on Jones. There's nothing you hang your hat on in this team right now. Like the Eagles are 7.5-point favorites on Sunday Night Football.
Damn.
More than a touchdown.
Yeah.
They're 2-4-1, the Eagles are. They barely squeaked out a 12-point comeback against the New York Giants. And the books have him as a more than touchdown favorite against the Cowboys. That's how little faith there is in Dallas right now.
Yeah, no, I believe it. We're going to get to our most surprising records, but before we do, we got to remind the people that Built Bar has the best protein bars on the planet. Not just with taste, but for your macros too. They're a great balance of just the right amount of calories with a lot of protein and not a ton of sugar. You could eat them right when you wake up, right before a workout, right after workout. You could even have two of these bad boys as a little meal replacement in the middle of the day. They got 18 amazing flavors. They just redid their flavor formula. So if you love what they had, a couple of months ago, you're going to love the same great flavors even more because they were able to fine-tune it a little bit. If you head over to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCK. That's all caps, no spaces, LOCKED ON. It's not just LOCKED, it's LOCKED ON. You get 20% off your next order. You use the promo code LOCKED ON, get 20% off, whether you're getting Built Go packs, which we've talked before about this podcast, the little energy packs they have, a box of one flavor, a mixed box of three flavors, 18 boxes of mixed flavors, whatever it is. Whatever your cart's got in there, you're going to get 20% off over at BuiltBar.com. Ben, let's talk about some surprising records as we do every single week. Who's your most surprising record this week?
Yeah, I know a lot of Steelers fans.
Your father?
My father, my sister, one of my best man at my wedding. I know a lot of Steelers fans. I wrote about the 2-0 teams. I called Pittsburgh a pretender because I didn't think Roethlisberger's arm could hack it. They're 6-0. I still don't think Roethlisberger's arm can hack it. You know, this is kind of like a I'd like to apologize to absolutely nobody situation.
This is what it feels like.
Yeah. NFL Next Gen stats. Ben Roethlisberger, he had 3 completions on passes that went more than 8 yards down the field against the Titans, which is stunning. His only 3 passing attempts that went beyond 20 yards downfield were an incompletion and then 2 interceptions. He continues to not be the best downfield thrower. And the addition of Matt Canada to this offensive coaching staff is largely about maximizing horizontal space, getting quick, easy explosives, because they really are catering the passing attack now to a quarterback who cannot push the ball down the field with the same amount of consistency. The regularity. Roethlisberger's deep passing used to be all about surviving in the pocket and throwing like a broken play late to a big post 50 yards down the field. If they want to go deep now, it has to be like, you know, in rhythm on the sideline. That's the best that we've got, right? So it is surprising. The Steelers are now officially the last unbeaten team, but with their defeat of the Titans and then the Seattle Seahawks falling to Arizona on Sunday Night Football, they are 6-0. I don't think anybody got close to the Steelers being the top, the only undefeated team, the last undefeated team left. I think they would have probably been like 10th, 11th in your guesses, especially looking at their early schedule, right? If they had a Houston team that a lot of people expected to be good. Obviously, you have the Tennessee Titans. They had the Eagles, who people thought might be better coming into this year. So 6-0 for them. Ravens coming up. Titans was the heat check game, and they cleared it by the skin of their teeth. You can't even call the Ravens that because it's a divisional game and the blood is bad, right? So this is like, throw everything you know about the teams out of the window. This is going to be just a heavyweight.
Is this a Monday Night Football game? When is this?
It's currently 1 p.m. The Eagles-Cowboys is currently the Sunday Night
Please, NFL, don't make us do this. Please.
For the sake of my scheduling, I would like for the Eagles-Cowboys game to be at 1. And Steelers-Ravens would be a really fun Sunday Night game. So, yeah, it's the most surprising record that they're 6-0. It's wild. Could they beat the Chiefs right now? Are they going to beat the Ravens?
No.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's just.
Yeah, they are. I'm taking the Steelers. Yeah, I'll say they win.
I struggle to convince myself that this team is an eight. Like, it's like you said with the Bucks, right? Like, you have to, like, put the Bucks, like, at least in this top tier, in this top conversation. Record-wise, the Steelers look like it, but you put on the film, there's concerning stuff.
My most surprising record, and it's, I don't know if it's really that surprising, because you and I actually laid it out, like, how easy the Cleveland Browns had a road to win this year because of their schedule, but here they are. They're now 5-2 after a thrilling late comeback against the Cincinnati Bengals. It was a blow-for-blow fourth quarter between Baker Mayfield and Joe Burrow, but, like, Baker has not looked great this year. There are times when he was brilliant. For example, he had 15 straight completions in this game. That was after he went 0-for-5 with an interception on his first two drives.
All it took, Trevor, was me tweeting out the photo of him trying to open the door from the Heisman commercial. That's all it took. Baker saw that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but what was the engagement? What were the retweets and the likes? That's great. That's a good tweet.
I don't think it was that good. It's a little bit of a niche reference. I don't think as many people watch. Yeah, 2 retweets, 43 likes.
That's it? Oh, wow. Come on. Ben's followers got to step up.
Somebody tweeted, it's how Baker went from 0 for 5 to 15 for 15. I don't understand. I just quote tweeted it with the image of him trying to open the door.
I mean, the Bengals didn't have Joe Mixon in this one, but Joe Burrow, over 400 yards, 3 touchdowns. He threw an interception on his first drive as well, which, you know, Baker and Joe Burrow, really appreciate them shouting out Jameis Winston again here in another week, throwing an interception on their first series. But Joe Burrow is my rookie of the week, so I guess I'm combining this a little bit here because I just brought him up. But on the flip side, Baker Mayfield has really struggled this year to step up in the ways that we have wanted him to. There have been a couple of instances where he has done enough, or they have come back enough to have this 5-2 record, but it's not like the Browns are sitting here a convincing 5-2. I mean, their blowout losses are to the two teams in their own division that they're fighting against. Now, the playoff format now opens the door a little bit, so they can still be a postseason team, but man, it's just, is Baker ever going to be not this roller coaster, hot and cold quarterback enough for the Browns to actually take this next step and be a legit consistent threat against the good teams every single week? Because right now, when I look at that 5-2 record, I can look at the schedule and go, yeah, that's not surprising. But when I look at how the most important piece of their puzzle is playing right now, I go, 5-2. I look at the other teams that are close to 5-2 or 6-1 or whatever it is, and I go, Browns ain't that. Browns are clearly at the bottom of whatever would be that kind of record tier. And I think that Mayfield's a reason. So, shoot, I hope that this is a big turnaround for him. Like, I sure hope that he takes this momentum is real, into the next week. But I'll believe it when I see it about the Cleveland Browns. And so that's why I think that their record of 5-2 is still surprising.
Yeah, I'll never forget when they lost the Ravens 38-6 in week one, and the amount of people I saw who were like, well, obviously, because Kevin Stefanski's a bad hire. And I was just like, what? It is week one. It was COVID offseason. Let us relax. Now, they're 5-2. Their point differential is minus 21. That's because they beat the Bengals by 5, Washington by 14, Cowboys by 11, Colts by 9, and then the Bengals by 3. They lost to the Ravens by 32, and they lost to the Steelers by 31. Suboptimal. If you can't, and the thing is, like, if the biggest issue with the Browns this year is that they can't punch with the top teams in their division, listen, they took a step forward, because the Ravens and Steelers are obviously two pretty doggone good football teams in the AFC. Obviously, divisional games are always tougher. They know you better. They know what you like to do. They prepared for you, so on and so forth. They beat the Colts 32-23. That was an important game for them, because the Colts at that time, if you remember, I think were 3-1. The Browns were also 3-1 at that time. And that felt like a game where if they were going to be an AFC wildcard contender, they needed to win that game. They did. The very next week, they got waxed by the Steelers. And then they have this win against the Bengals. Next week, they catch the Raiders. Well, guess what? If you're going to be an AFC wildcard team, gotta beat the Raiders.
They better, they better beat the Raiders, right?
Raiders are a good 3-3. You know what I mean? Like the Browns at home are favored by 3 points in this game, which is to say, on a neutral field, these teams are viewed as even teams. So are the Browns a 5-2 team? Actually, probably not. They're probably a 4-3 team. They're probably, you know, right around 500, pushing for the AFC wild card. And again, if they end the season like that, that's an improvement. But I agree with you. I do think the Browns are a little bit lying to us. They're a little bit fallacious, a little bit of posers. But listen, I mean, if you beat the Colts and if you beat the Raiders head-to-head, well, when we get to wild card time, you're going to have some important head-to-head victories. So do you need to be the most legit 5-2? No, you need to win the important games. And losing the Division I suck. It's going to make it really hard to hang around in that conversation, which is you know, if they beat the Raiders, assuming Baltimore beats the Steelers, then it's 6-1, 6-1, 6-2. It's not like Cleveland will be out of this thing record-wise. Obviously, they don't look like they can punch it at the Steelers and the Ravens late. It's just you beat the Raiders, you're going to be obviously right at the top number 5 seed for the AFC. And in the first year of Stefanski, and like you said, with the way Mayfield's playing, that's a humongous win. Again, even if it's not super true, even if it like you got a little bit lucky, you at least get to put the feather in the cap. And for the Browns, that's a relief, right? You start to get that monkey off your back. So it's encouraging to see them win these early games. Those games are important for them. If they beat the Raiders here as well, that AFC wildcard race is theirs. They're going to be clearly in the front of it. And a playoff berth for Cleveland in year one is tremendous news.
I said that Joe Burrow was my rookie of the week. He had 400 yards passing. I believe became the first Bengal with 400 yards passing in a rookie season. I know that he tied second place for the most 300-yard games in a rookie season. He is now one game short of Andrew Luck, who has the record at 6. He has done it 5 times, and he's got, let's do quick math here, 9 more games to do it. So I think that Joe Burrow is going to take that record, which has been nice. So that's why I'm giving him Rookie of the Week this week for taking that milestone for the Bengals and getting one step closer to an NFL milestone for the rookie. Who is your Rookie of the Week?
Oh, I have my mic. Quick question for you right beforehand, though. Who's playing better, Herbert or Burrow? Who's your offensive rookie of the year? Ready, pick, go. Now, choose.
Man, that's good. I would say Herbert.
That's correct.
Yeah, I would say
Herbert. I think Burrow's playing great. I think Burrow's that which he was billed as, and I think that Herbert is playing absolutely nuts.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I got to give some love to Antonio Gibson, man. Memphis running back, 33 career carries, as everybody's talked about. I loved his film. I loved him as a prospect. He gets picked early third round, which I thought was at the high end of his projection. Washington cuts Adrian Peterson. This guy's going to be our bell cow back. And I was like, all right, that's exciting. That's great. That's a lot of fun. But like, we have to relax on early projections for Gibson. He's going to be raw as he continues to grow into the position. And he is raw, and he is continuing to grow into the position. But this was the first game that the Washington football team controlled game script-wise. So Gibson got a significant amount of rushing work and did not get laid down work. He had 0 receptions for the first time in his career this game. 20 carries, 128 yards. He had a touchdown. He had 2 explosives. Is it perfect? No. Is it getting better? Yep. And that's what it is with Gibson. It's when you give him these reps, and he doesn't have a lot of them under his belt. He starts to acclimate, his instincts start to hone, and by the end of the season, by the beginning of next season, you've got the guy you drafted. That's how development works. It's really nice to see him get a bell cow look in the backfield. His most productive game to date. The explosive runs were really important. He's learning how to maximize his blockers. Gibson's growing into what they hoped he would be. Gibson's growing into the prospect I thought that you maybe could get out of him off that Memphis film. Really, really exciting stuff.
I'll keep the mic on you for the dumbest thing that we saw this week before we wrap up kind of our thoughts on the rest of the league and get out of here. What is the dumbest thing you saw this week?
If anybody doesn't watch college football, Penn State was leading Indiana by 1 point with less than 2 minutes in the game. Their third string running back was given the football about 12-yard line on a handoff. And Indiana was like, oh no, let's stop him. But they weren't actually trying to stop him. And just too late, the third string running back realized that they were letting him score. Because obviously it's a 1 point game. If you score that touchdown, it's a 7 point game. And right. If you just kick the extra point, which is what they subsequently did, it's going to be an 8 point game. Indiana gets the football back with an opportunity to tie the game. Whereas if you just kneeled it out, game's over. So that running back, I think his name was Devin Ford, third string running back, is an 18, 19-year-old kid. His coaches are responsible for getting him into that moment. The coaches should know they have to walk him through that. They didn't. And the third string running back makes that mistake. Indiana ends up winning that football game. Amazing fashion. And a lot of it falls on a lot of different people, but you can't ignore the impact of that one play. Poor situational awareness, poor coaching. Veteran running back Todd Gurley for the Atlanta Falcons, who's a pro, okay? Who's paid millions of dollars to run the football in the National Football League. First and goal from the 10. 1:04 left. Down by 2. All you have to do is play for the field goal here and be the last possession. Or score the touchdown. Last possession. And not give the ball back to the Lions. First and goal from the 10. Lions, oh no, we're going to stop Todd Gurley. Oh dang, we missed the tackle. That's so sad. Todd Gurley realizes this at the half-yard line. And let's be honest, should have had the athleticism to not fall onto the end line. I think that was the weirdest fall ever. He fell the wrong way.
Yeah.
And this is not like, oh, you remember that one time Brian Westbrook? No. This just happened yesterday. It was on Instagram. You can't claim you didn't see it. 8-year vet, 7-year vet, Todd Gurley, 7, 8, whatever. You're a vet, dude. How do you not know this? So he scores. Falcons score a 2-point conversion. They go up by 6. The Lions get the ball back. And because the Falcons are the Falcons, the Lions score a game-winning touchdown. Back-to-back, Saturday to Sunday, running backs who should know to go on a knee. They don't. They score, and their team subsequently loses. You can forgive the true sophomore third stringer. Can't forgive Todd Gurley, man. Come on.
Let me set the stage for y'all. Seattle Seahawks, Arizona Cardinals, big divisional game. Goes right down to the wire. In fact, 4 quarters was not enough to settle this one. They had to go to overtime. Geno Smith, coin flip god, wins it for the Seattle Seahawks. So the Seahawks are on offense first. They've got Russell Wilson. You know the game's over. You're basically packing it in. You're brushing your teeth already. You're getting ready for bed. It's over, right? Wrong. Vance Joseph dials up an amazing blitz design that completely fooled the Seahawks offensive line on third down, sacks Russell Wilson. They are forced to punt the ball. They punt it to Arizona. Arizona, who had a lot of success moving the ball in the previous drives during regulation to bring it to a tie, once again, moved the ball down the field. Big part of that was a 32-yard run by running back Chase Edmonds, who got them into field goal range immediately. They ran, I believe, 2 more plays after that to get another first down. They get to the 18-yard line. Kyler Murray then sets up exactly where they want the ball to go for the field goal. And then on second down, they decide to try to kick the game-winning field goal. Now, they're close enough. It's a 40-yard field goal. You should make it. Okay, game should be over. You don't want to risk a botched snap. You don't want to risk a bad handoff, fumbling the ball, whatever it is. I get it. It's still stupid. Don't do that. You can get more yards towards your goal, make the field goal even easier. But instead, what they actually did is they lined up to take a field goal. The clock was running down. They were about to take a delay of game penalty. So the ball gets snapped. The kicker throws it up there. It's good. But oh, wait. Cliff Kingsbury had to call a timeout to make sure the delay of game penalty wasn't called on them. And they backed the field goal up even more. So another 41-yard attempt. And it's missed. They missed it. Now, the end of the game. They end up being victorious. They get a little bit of redemption. They win 37-34. However, stop kicking on second down. Run the ball. Be well coached enough and well disciplined enough to run the ball, get the yards that you need to. Seattle's defense isn't good. You didn't have to do that. I understand that he made the first field goal, so it shouldn't have mattered anyways, but that whole entire sequence was the dumbest thing that I saw this week. We did have a team funeral, but we don't have enough time to get to it, so I guarantee that they're probably going to lose next week. We're just going to have to keep it a mystery, and we will bury them next week. What are some around-the-league thoughts? Because I know that there were some things that we did not get to that I want to get to before we get out of here.
Niners run game? Absolutely freaking nuts.
Yep.
Jeff Wilson had like 30 carries for 130 yards and 3 touchdowns.
And if you've never heard of Jeff Wilson before, my response to that is, yep,
Yeah, guess what? Jeff Wilson also seems to be losing time to injury because this is the rule of the San Francisco 49ers in 2020. So JaMychal Hasty, Baylor, rookie, I liked him. He's probably going to get big touches next week. The Shanahan offense continues to run all over the Patriots, 33-6, tremendous win. Something's wrong with Cam Newton. Not good. Got to dial in on that.
Oh, man, yeah.
Congrats to Justin Herbert. First win of the career, 39-29 over the Jacksonville Jaguars. As we brought up, I think Herbert is playing better than any rookie right now. I think this is your favorite for offensive rookie of the year at the halfway point of the season. Put a 70-yard dot on Jalen Guyton. He has 3 touchdowns and, critically, no interceptions. Herbert playing well and accurately and aggressively and explosively is one thing. The few mistakes he's made is really the impressive part. They end up beating Jacksonville. Herbert gets his first win after several weeks of quality play. You love to see it.
Yeah, we need to start worrying about the New England Patriots. Cam, for as well as he kind of started things out for them when they were able to keep control and they were able to run the ball the way that they wanted to, he, I think, has 2 passing touchdowns and 7 interceptions on the season. It's just like, it just has not been good for Cam. Now, the offensive staff around him has not been great either, and I think that that's coming to show on their record now, too. Bill Belichick basically said that they did nothing well yesterday. Just absolutely nothing, which is not great. The Jets, Adam Gase turned over play calling duties to Dow Loggins, the offensive coordinator. And let me tell you how well things go for an offensive head coach who was brought in to be an offensive genius who now has to relegate play call duties because he's not good at his job. Let me tell you how well that works out. Doesn't.
Oh, okay.
That does not work out. However, the Jets offense actually showed a little bit of life yesterday. They were using play action, misdirection. They were using different hard counts. They were actually having creativity in what they did, which was nice to see. But they are also still the Jets. Not great in Denver either. Denver struggled this week after a nice win last week. Drew Lock just, I know it was a snow game. I know there are a lot of things that were going wrong, but man, they just did not look like they were any kind of caliber team against the Kansas City Chiefs, which I get that it's the Chiefs, but you'd still like to put up more of a fight in the loss the way that they did. So that was it. That's the league from us. Hope you guys enjoyed the recap here. Tomorrow, recap in college football. Ben gave a little bit of a mention of the wild weekend that was in college football on Saturday. We're going to go back and relive our favorite moments from this past weekend with not only significant notes from the college football season, but also, of course, from a scouting perspective, as this is an NFL Draft podcast. That's tomorrow. Until then, you guys keep it locked right here on Locked On NFL Draft.